Welcome back to Jump Scare. I'm Betty.
And I'm Shad.
We end the month with the double features of The Dark Half and In the Mouth of Madness.
Thad Beaumont has a secret.
I know all about it.
A piece of himself he keeps hidden.
You just don't want to give up George. You become attached to him.
Locked away until he needs it.
These behaviors could be interpreted as schizophrenia.
Away from the light, safe in the shadows.
I wrote those words, and I have no recollection of doing it.
But sometimes, secrets take on a life of their own. Thad Beaumont thought he didn't need George Stark anymore.
The American way of death.
That's it.
He served his purpose. Time to lay him to rest. But George is not about to go quietly.
You really don't realize what you like when you write those books, do you? It's like watching Jekyll turn into Hyde.
We're here to question you in connection with a capital crime.
Evidence says you did it.
George Stark has somehow come to life.
Hello, George.
I can come closer to believing the ghost story than this. You're talking about a man who never was.
No!
He wants to take over your life. Can't you see that?
Based upon a book by Stephen King comes George A. Romero's masterful vision of a nightmare come true.
Are you ready?
Just waiting on you.
The Dark Half.
The Dark Half. Now, this is a Stephen King novel adapted into film.
Yep.
And Shad is a huge King fan.
Yes.
We have...
There's only three of his I haven't read.
That's intense. What three? I'm intrigued. What three have you not read?
I have never read In the Eyes of the Dragon.
Oh, I've read that.
Insomnia. And Rose Matter.
Okay. Is that the Rose Red one?
No. It's just called Rose Matter, but it's nothing with the Rose Red movie or anything.
Oh, okay. Okay. Wait, is that not his?
That's his, but it's just a different tan. Okay. Yeah.
It's been a long time since I've seen Rose Red, and I remember when I watched it on TV, I hated it.
Yeah, this is about a haunted painting, Rose Matter is.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Well, but I haven't read it. I've just read the back of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm saying, but the concept, though, I like the haunting. I like things with paintings, you know, like Dorian Gray. I hadn't seen this movie in a really long time. It was actually like watching it for the first time. It had been at least 20 plus years since I've seen the film.
I saw it when it first came out in the theaters, and then I've seen it once or twice before I bought the like fancy Screen Factory Blu-ray that came out with 4 or 5 years ago. I got it, and I really like that one because it's got a lot of really cool special features on it.
Now, the film is, I want to say autobiographical.
Yeah, because it's the whole, everyone knows Stephen King was Richard Bachman, and... In real life, when he was discovered, that it was, oh, hey, you're really Richard Bachman, right? He did a whole publicity thing where they, you know, buried Richard Bachman. They dug a grave for him, and I think they threw some books in it and buried him. And it's like, well, that's the end of Richard Bachman, which they do in this as well. You have the main character, which is Thad Beaumont, who writes, like, artsy books that are very, you know, critically well-received but don't make any money. So he starts writing these crime novels under the name George Stark. And it's all about a vicious hitman named Alexis Machine. And all the books, at least in the novel, they show the books, and they're all like Machine's Way and all this. Like, that's all like the titles of them are all about, you know, the guy called the Machine. And
so, like, Beaumont is really...
Stephen King.
No, it's really Richard Bachman. And Stephen King is really George Stark. Beaumont, like Bachman, you know, got a little bit of money, but his books are not like known, like so, you know, like Stephen King's books are. And obviously, Stephen King and Stark have the deprived, you know, fucked up books.
I always love when the Running Man movie came out that they didn't slap Stephen King's name on it. It said, you know, based on the novel by Richard Bachman. I always thought they would, you know, since they started publishing them as Stephen King later, I figured they would just slap Stephen King's name on that to try and get attention. You know, the 80s were a perfect time to do that.
I didn't even know that was even a thing. So there you go.
Yeah, it's a lot different than the movie. In the book, they just turn you loose. And if you manage to survive out in the world without being killed by the hunters for 30 days, you get $1 billion.
Wow.
But nobody's made it more than like 5 days or whatever. And then until, you know, the Schwarzenegger character plays it and then he goes crazy with it. But it's a whole different kind of thing. Which is funny because the Running Man ended up creating all the real fucking reality shows like the, you know, American Gladiators and shit. They just did it for real. So once again, Stephen King predicts the future.
He sure does, man. He's pretty awesome.
He did some good drugs, is what I think.
I don't think he hid that, and he drank a lot.
Yeah, so he did some good shit.
You can definitely tell in the difference in this writing from when he was all messed up, and also how crazy the books get to when he's not messed up.
Yeah, and you can tell periods in him, like the, you know, before the accident and after the accident.
He's gotten a lot better. I mean, I've read some of his novels, not, you know, a lot of them like you have. But, you know, I read The Shining and then I read Dr. Sleep. And between those two novels, there's a dramatic difference.
Yeah, the older novels, he gets really hung up on, like, small details. Yes. And you know everything about that. You know the
guy history of the curtains.
Yep, you know the history of the curtains, the guy who installed the curtains, who built the guy who installed the curtains' house. You know all about everything. And he kind of gets away from that in the later novels and just kind of focuses more on a few characters, and that's that, which I'm okay with.
Well, in this crazy, you know, there comes a point in the movie where you're like, is this really fucking happening? Like, how could this be happening if we all know that he's the guy? But, and they kind of explain it a little bit, you know, but not really, because it's very unbelievable. Like, it's just way the fuck out there.
Yeah, this is kind of a dry run for the outsider in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah, I totally see that, for sure.
But, so basically, the plot of it is, you find out that Thad, when he was younger, had a twin. He was a twin who absorbed the other twin in the womb. And when he was born, when he was maybe 8 or 9, he started having headaches, getting ill, and they have to take him in for brain surgery, and they discover in his brain is, you know, like you do sometimes, you find an eyeball and some teeth in the guy's brain.
Ew, and that part's so disgusting.
So they take those out.
He had a twin. The twin ate the other twin.
Right? That's what I said.
Oh, you did? Okay, I'm sorry. I just totally missed it. Go ahead. Brain and, teeth.
They just bury. They don't just, like, you know, throw those parts away. They actually, the family insists on burying them, which comes into play later because when, you know, Thad decides to kill off George Stark and do the whole, you know, they just admit to who he is because someone's trying to blackmail him. So rather than blackmailing, you know, pay the blackmailer, they just admit to who it is. And after he kills off George Stark and buries him in the family plot, which he didn't know his, you know, the eyeballs and teeth from his unborn twin were there, that's when mysteriously George Stark just rises up out of the grave and starts going around killing people. And that's where things get weird, because the first guy he kills is... Now, this movie's written and directed by George Romero. The first guy he kills looks just like George Romero.
It's literally... I was like, is that George Romero? Because he's wearing the same... Like, everything, every detail of his outfit is something Romero probably owned in his closet. Definitely we've seen him wear it.
Yeah, like at every convention I've seen Romero at, he's always wearing like the photographer vest with all the pockets and the, you know, the big glasses. That's exactly what this guy is wearing. He's, you know, he's the photographer that takes the pictures of everything, and he's the first guy that gets killed by George Stark. And you're like, wow, did Romero, like, was he feeling okay? Did he just want to, or did they just do that as a joke? Just dress the guy up and have him look like Romero?
It must have been just a joke. There's no way that it wasn't a joke.
Yeah, that's where we meet, when he gets killed, we meet the sheriff in the town, which is Sheriff Pangborn, who we'll see later on in Needful Things, Castle Rock, the series. He shows up in quite a few things here and there.
We've probably covered a podcast. We definitely did the Castle Rock series, yeah, and we did Needful Things. So he's been around in our
podcast. He's like the third guy to play Sheriff Pangborn on this. And this time he's played by Michael Rooker, who I have to say, he gives a great interview on the DVD where he's just like, yep, I went into this movie and I didn't know any of the actors and I wasn't friends with any of them. And I'm still not.
Yeah,
he's like, wow, okay. Not having a good time on that movie, are you, Michael Rooker?
So in case you didn't know, this film has the main consensus between everyone that worked in the film was Timothy, what's his face?
Timothy Hutton.
Timothy Hutton is a douchebag.
Yeah. He, on the DVD, they talk about how he insisted on having separate trailers for when he was going to be playing George Stark and for when he was going to be playing Thad Beaumont.
He was big time method, because he learned a certain way of acting, and that's the way that he did all of his performances, and he was living and breathing these characters.
And George Romero and Michael Rooker are the kind of people that are very chill.
They're clock in, clock out.
They're very laid back. They're like, hey, let's get in there and let's make a movie. They're very calm. They're very relaxed. They're not method kind of people. They don't take it as seriously as Timothy Hutton did. I mean, they do their jobs, but they're not as uptight about it as he was, apparently.
Because he was very uptight.
Yeah, he could only be spoken to if he was in George Stark character, you had to address him as George. You couldn't address him as anything else. And apparently there was one scene where he just had to drive down the road, but he had to, he had to delay the scene and do it a dozen times because he just wasn't feeling it. All he had to do was drive 10 feet down the road and look over his shoulder. I guess it took, according to the Blu-ray, 5 hours to film a 30-second scene.
That's insane.
But, so, pretty quick in the movie, the George Stark character kills the Romero lookalike. And they find the guy's truck covered in blood and fingerprints everywhere. They run the fingerprints, and sure enough, they come back to Thad. And, they don't arrest him, which is kind of odd.
Well, because he's known. It's a small town. The officer, knows these people. This is a guy. It's the freaking coach of the Little League. And
The outsider.
No, it's the outsider, yes. But I'm saying he's a well-known, person that lives in town that's very much into, the town's activities and is sought to be, a good citizen and stuff like that. He's not. So that they're like, it's unbelievable. And then his wife has cred too, I guess, because, she's no bullshit wife. So
yeah,
it's like, no, this is, I believe what's going on. It's kind of iffy. I don't know. It's kind of sus, but you have alibis and they're pretty solid. And that's crazy.
Yeah, because in the first murder that happens, he was in New York and he's got people there that can see him. They all confirm that he was there. But then the murders just keep happening.
Yeah, this is we're talking about this and all I'm thinking about is The Outsider. But wait, before we get into further the story, didn't you tell me that whole scene with the photographer and him taking pictures by the grave or whatever, Stephen King actually did that in his real life? Wait, did you mention that earlier?
Yes. I talked about it extensively at the beginning of this podcast.
You know what? I'm going to be honest, listeners. I may or may not be on another world right now. Am I even listening to anything Shot's saying in this podcast?
No, she's not.
I'm not. I'm going to be honest because I'm so, I'm enthralled with what's going on. But at the same time, I'm very much into what one of the cats is doing because she's walking around. It's hunting. It's the nighttime right now. She's hunting about, and this is one of our cats that needs a lot of attention and love because, then the other one's trying to eat the other one's food. There's a little, it's like, what's that freaking,
oh my Meowington God. In place?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So yes, they actually did this.
West Side Story. It's a West Side Story with cats. That's what I was thinking. So go ahead.
So anyhow. I don't know where I was.
So you were talking about how he gets the phone call, whatever. He can't be in the place at the same time.
Yeah. So they figure out pretty quick that they know, it looks like him, but at the same time it can't be because he's actually talking to the sheriff on the phone when one of the murders happens. So they know there's a pretty solid alibi there. And, you know, George Stark calls him and starts making, you know, like threats to him. And I love when you can see like the 90s technology of like they come and install the box to trace the calls. It's like the size of a shoebox and just has a big red light on the top of it that flashes to let you know there's a call coming in. It's like watching Black Christmas when they're down in like the phone company and it's like five guys moving wires and everything to try to trace the call.
I literally was thinking about Black Christmas when you're saying it. I was like, well, at least it's not like Black Christmas where they had to go through like 9,000 rows just to see, like, follow the blinking light to put the fucking thing in it like they used to back in the day. That's just crazy.
Yeah, but so it's a little funny to watch the old technology like that because you're thinking, God, man, now they just call the phone company and go, hey, where did that call come from? That's it. They can tell you exactly where the person was standing.
No one's running through a corridor of like freaking, you know, computers the size of your fucking house.
They don't have to be down in the basement with a special, like, the weird phone, like, all the linemen used to have, like, the weird, like, phone. It was, like, a red thing with, like, the dial on the back or something, you know?
Yeah, none of that's happening. It's just click.
So, yeah, it's...
The wife is pretty supportive. I mean, and they, you know, obviously he's a twin, so they have twins, and they have their hands full because, you know, they're, like... 1+ years old and there's nothing but, you know, diapers and bullshit to have to be had there. And, you know, then your like husband is freaking saying like, oh, he's a murderer, like he's going out murdering, like, you know, when you're going to sleep he's waking up and doing these things, and he's going, you know, he says he's gonna go to the supermarket to buy milk and he's off fucking slicing someone up, and you're like, I don't think so. She stood by him very good. Well,
yeah, she was 100% like, nope, it's not him.
There's one very graphic scene where he, right at the beginning, when the blackmailer, after when he comes home from the whole blackmail thing, he tells his wife, like, you know, someone should cut his penis off and like shove it down his throat. And then later on,
that's exactly what happens to the guy.
And when he says it out loud, the wife is like, because she was there when he said it. So that right there, I would have been like, no, 911, you're fucking no, you're no.
Yeah, you're guilty. You need to talk to this guy.
Because it was very specific. I mean, it's just like you cut someone's penis off and then you shove it down their throat. I mean, how many people are going to have that same thought?
Yeah.
You know, if it's not the same person, which technically it was, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
Like, how did this entity, I don't want to call it entity, how did the being literally, like, is able to walk around and do these things?
Yeah, they didn't really explain that too deeply. It was just kind of like, because of, you know, whatever was going on with him, maybe, you know, some kind of like the twin spirit came out somehow.
Yeah, I don't
know.
There his was a colleague lot of things. They gave a little bit of, I don't want to say backstory, but like research, because the colleague, Thad Beaumont, is a professor in a college, and there was another professor there who was his friend, and she is the one that finds like the information on, you know, what's going on and whatnot, and comes back and says like, oh yeah, you know, when you put life into a thing, because your mind is very powerful, it comes into fruition, and that thing like literally starts to have a life of on its own, because it's thriving on that kind of thing, which is a very intense thought, but okay, we're gonna fucking wing it. This is happening. George Stark. And let me tell you, for all this shit that Timothy Hutton gets for this, I thought his performance was fucking excellent. And him as George Stark, like, I've seen him in other movies, and he's always like the nice, you know, sweet guy. And to see him in this role where he's just
cutting people's throats and going
crazy.
He's
hardcore. Like, is he wearing a gold bracelet in one of those scenes? I don't know. He reminds me of like a Guido cowboy. Like, he's weird.
Yeah. Yeah, his car that he has a sticker on the back that says "High Toned Son of a Bitch." I'm like, what? Why do you have that?
Yeah, he's just a greaseball. He's just a greaseball cowboy, and they put prosthetics in his face, which of course adds, you know, anyone that has listened to any actor talk about how, you know, when they go through that kind of transformation, they really are someone else and they really get into it because there's inhibition. Like, you don't have any of that. You're no longer yourself.
Yeah, so you can it's just very free.
And he definitely explores the dark sides within that character very well, I think. For his performance alone, that's why I like the movie, because you do see a completely two different people.
Now, they kind of left this character out of the movie, but in the book, his Thad's best friend was a professor, another professor at the college, and it was the professor who coincidentally had a wife named Wilma that everyone says to call Billy, which is Adrian Barbeau from Creepshow. So they implied that, like, that guy was, you know, his friend at the college. So I thought that was kind of a cool little tie-in to it.
And if you didn't know, George Romero.
Yeah, directed Creepshow.
Directed Creepshow.
So that was tied in even before the movie came out with Romero. And I gotta say, this is probably one of the more, like, faithful adaptions of Stephen King stuff, because it's almost chapter for chapter the novel. The only thing they did was maybe combine a few characters here and there. Otherwise, it's pretty much the book, right down to the ending. And, you know, it goes along, and basically George, of course, comes after Thad and is like, only one of us is going to make it through this, and it's going to be me. And, you know, he kidnaps the wife, the kids, like, you know, it's going to happen. Like, from the very beginning, you know that's going to happen. And they have to kind of have a showdown in their, like, remote cabin out in Castle Rock. And because everybody has a remote cabin in Castle Rock in Stephen King country. Everybody lives near Castle Rock in an old cabin of some kind.
This is where the shit is going down in Castle Rock, in case you missed all of our other Stephen King-esque episodes. Castle Rock is a hotbed of fucking activity.
It's one of those places, like, why the hell does anybody even live there?
Like, this should be population one, and that's the fucking...
The guy who tells you not to come into Castle Rock?
Well, no, I was going to say it's, what's his face, the vampire from Salem's Lot, but fine. Yes.
That's me, the guy who just tells you, no, don't come in. You don't want... It's like living in Sunnydale or wherever the hell...
Well, I guess he'd be... Actually, I guess he'd be saying, yes, come in. He'd be saying the opposite. He'd be saying, yes, come in.
Yeah, or living in... Where the hell did the murder... Oh, Cabot's Cove, where the Murder, She Wrote woman lived, like, every fucking week. It's a town of, like, 400 people, and they have, like, 25 murders a year at the place. Eventually, somebody's going to be left there but fucking Jessica Fletcher. But yeah, you don't want to live in this town. It's not going to be good for you. And, has a creepy kind of ending with there's some really great effects where it's, you know, the character of George Stark is torn apart by birds, which the birds appeared on the day that they took the tumor out of Thad's head, and then the birds come back. And
are they
sparrows? Said,
they're sparrows, but in the novel they were ravens, crows. I think they were another bird in the novel. But so there were sparrows that, like, kind of pick them apart. And I think sparrows are nice. And they give a whole explanation on the whole sparrow thing, too, on why it's that bird and whatnot. But they're so nice. But these were actual, like, it was real sparrows.
Yeah, like real birds. And then they come mixed it with mechanical birds.
Oh,
and
the mechanical bird. If you get to watch, I never watched the behind the scenes on any of this stuff, but if you do, the mechanical bird on here that they make, I'm like, where can I get my fucking mechanical bird? Because it is prettily, I can't even, it's so amazing. I'm just,
no, it
like,
is sparrows in the novel too.
Oh, okay. It's definitely, I would want one. I need one of those.
Yeah, they do a great job with the mechanical birds and the mechanical George Stark. I didn't realize when they were showing it that it was at first. Later on, it's obviously not a guy, but I didn't realize they had a full mechanical guy at first. I thought it was just Timothy Hutton his stand-in in the makeup.
Yeah, no, it looks pretty decent for the time frame that this movie.
Yeah, because there wasn't a lot of digital effects in this. Most of everything in here was practical, and they just used a few digital things to enhance it. And what they did worked out really well.
Yeah, it did. I give this film, I'm thinking, I want to say 2.5 knives, close to 3 knives.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's a 3 out of 4.
Yeah, well, you're going to have, like, a higher... You have, like, a whole backstory. You have, like, so much history because you read the novels. So it's, like, this is just, like, an add-on and probably, you know, what you read come to life to some degree.
Yeah, for the most part. Like I said, it's really pretty faithful to the book. They don't change a whole lot. Just they kind of combined a couple of characters, but it's side characters that you don't really need. They changed his friend in the college from a man to a woman, but... Not really. because they couldn't really reference Creepshow in the movie at the time, because back at the time, movies didn't really do that. You know, they didn't reference other movies. And
it wasn't
that,
meta time.
It wasn't meta time. So there was no extended universe. Stephen King was doing it in all these books, but nobody was doing it in the movies.
Now, this film has something connected with the next film that we did, which is In the Mouth of Madness. Both are about writers.
And writers who have kind of a crazy, rabid fan base.
Yes. So stay tuned for In the Mouth of Madness.
Absolutely mad.
The riots began because the stores could not meet the demand of Sutter Kane's novel, In the Mouth of Madness.
Kane disappeared 2 months ago without a trace.
He's the guy that writes horror books.
You can forget about Stephen King. Kane outsells them all.
I need to know if he's alive or dead, and I need that book.
It's a setup. I just have to work out how it's set up.
Kane's writing has been known to have an effect on his readers.
See this? It's a map.
This whole thing has been staged.
You just get out.
This is not reality.
It's all happening for real, Trent.
Next month.
You know what I forgot to mention before we get into the In the Mouth of Madness is that there was an actual video game for this movie. How many like horror movies become a video game? This is for like the SNES by Capcom, and it's a beautiful looking, because I love that like 8-bit.
Yeah, it's one of those like text games, kind of like
for the PC.
Yeah, for the PC. It's like a, what was that one they had, like Gort or something like that? I can't remember the name of it. It was a strange, where you were like, it was like a Dungeons and Dragons kind of thing. You had to type in what you were going to do, and it gave you the weird little graphics. They had one like this for Nightbreed, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that reminds me of Big. Remember, there was like a, in Big, he was like, wanted to perfect the game that he was playing, and he, that's why when he grew up, he was in like the toys.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Thing, because he was like, oh, this game should be, was like a multiple, like a choose your own adventure game that, yeah, he was playing.
And the Nightbreed one, it was, all those games were so hard because you had to know exactly what to type in order to get it to do it, and they were just kind of frustrating. But this one looks cool, but I can imagine how frustrating it was to play, because all those were incredibly annoying.
Yeah, and it failed just like the film did. So
yeah, it, well, the movie was supposed to come out like a year and a half before it did. So maybe if the movie and the game came out at the same time, they would have done a little better.
Maybe. I guess in like early 90s, I can't even think about what I was even doing at that time. But would I have been interested in a... Well, I definitely couldn't have seen the movie. I would have been too young. My mom would have never let me see that.
But yeah, I couldn't... The game just doesn't look... I mean, it looks neat, but like a nostalgia thing. Like, if you actually had to play it, it would be horrible.
Totally. We would be mad as hell, because we would not be able to get that Beaumont to do anything.
No, you'd just be like, oh, and now you're dead. The Nightbreed one, I kept just, like, getting killed immediately by Decker all the time. It was like, and Decker kills you. Oh, okay.
Well, In the Mouth of Madness would be a cool game.
Yeah, it'd be cool if they do that one now, where you could do it like really well with like PlayStation or Xbox. That'd be a fun one.
Yeah, and it would be very crazy.
Yeah, I couldn't even imagine that game. The movie's a trip enough. Like the game, if you had, you could choose what you were doing, that'd be freaky as hell, but I'd love it.
In the Mouth of Madness is a John Carpenter film, and it is the film that completes his Apocalypse trilogy, which you have The Thing, Prince of Darkness, and then this one, which, you know, it's, you go from being like isolated to getting a little more into humanity and like going the God route, like ruining like the thought of God, and like you, Satan's coming back and all that. It's the beginning of the, you know, and then you have they're out, the demons, it's spreading like a fucking virus.
Well, and it's weird because Prince of Darkness is the only one with a somewhat happy ending, too. The Thing doesn't end on a very positive note. This one doesn't end on a very positive note. But Prince of Darkness, there was a little hope at the end of that one.
Didn't
that
they Susan Blanchard become the devil?
She went into the devil's dimension and...
did she get the slime on her?
No, they killed that one.
Is it insinuated that she got the slime? I was under the impression that she... gets taken over by the devil.
Well, they closed the dimension because, you know, what's his name? Donald Pleasance did that great axe throw that just like, mm-hmm. It was like a telekinetic axe throw because he threw it one handed and it just went flying straight into the mirror. I love that. But so I'd always assume they closed off the dimension in that one. And then later on, she was trying to come back out because she was trying to contact Mustache Man. What's his name? Parker Stevenson, I think is his name. She was trying to contact him.
We're going to have to watch the movie because we have different views on the ending of this film.
Yeah, that's fine. I've been wanting to watch it again anyhow, so.
But let's just say that it doesn't end well because that would be more apocalyptic.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. That's the only one I think had a happy ending.
Yeah.
Somewhat happy ending.
I don't know. But this film, it, you know, I saw it originally when it came out. It came out in 95?
Yeah, it was in 95.
And I remember watching it in a theater. And I don't have a clear memory of watching it since. So it may have been a long-ass time since I last seen this film. And there are certain parts that just stay with you because they're so fucking disturbing. I find them disturbing. I just, there's some things that just get me.
Yeah, I saw this in the theaters when it first came out, too. It was me and a friend of mine, and there was not that many people in the theater, of course, because poor John Carpenter's movies never do well in the theaters. But I just remember when, like, the lights came up and everybody was walking out, I heard somebody go, "What the fuck was that?" as they were leaving, because they were just, like, completely confused by it, had no idea. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, this one's going to do well.
Yeah, it is thought-provoking.
Yeah, and it's weird because there's so many people in this movie, and you don't hear it. You don't hear them talk about it a lot. You know what I mean? You don't be like, "Oh, this movie has Charlton Heston in it." This movie,
which
has...
I completely forgot. I was like, "Is that that guy? That old guy?" And Chad's like, "Charlton Heston." I was like, "Oh yeah,
it's him. It's Charlton Heston. You've got David Warner. You've got John Glover. And besides, of course, Sam Neill." Those people alone should make a hit movie.
I forgot David Warner was in the movie until I saw it. I love David Warner.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that anytime he's in a movie, it immediately goes up a notch just because it doesn't matter if it's robots versus lizard people. He comes in completely dignified like he's in fucking Hamlet. He comes in and just gives it, you know?
He's a classy dude.
Yeah, and this one, of course... kind of ties into our previous one because our last one dealt with Stephen King dealing with his own issues of being another personality writer. Well, this one's all about... Now, they call him Sutter Kane, which is pretty obviously Stephen King. They even go to say, oh, he outsells Stephen King. But really, he's more kind of a Lovecraft guy, to be honest, because all his stories, the books, are all like... the covers look like the Lovecraft covers you've seen. It's all like a Hobbs End horror... and, you know, they have names kind of like the Lovecraft stories. So they make it kind of like if Lovecraft had become as popular as Stephen King, what kind of a cult would he have had? And that'd be an interesting... that's part of what I liked about it, was because imagine if Lovecraft had been as popular when he was alive and they had actually copyrighted these things. What, you know, what would the world look like now? Because so many people have ripped him off over the years to make even better things. What would it have been like if he had kept the copyright on all that stuff and been super popular?
who knows where. Yeah, there's, I can think of, especially within the last, I would say, like, 10 years, Lovecraftian stuff has really blown up. Well, it's always been, like, you know, but it's really taken a whole other level recently. You got Sabrina, the Teenage Witch has, you know, her Lovecraftian episode, and there's definitely elements throughout. And then you have that Void movie, which I thought was kind of Lovecraftian in a way. Then you have The Color of Space. I mean, there's so many. I mean, obviously, and a lot of them are just blatantly
adaptions, you know,
homages and adaptions to his stories.
But I think it's because the technology's finally caught up with it. Because when you say something is, you know, a gigantic world-sized creature that destroys your mind to look at it, it was real hard to do that when you had to do everything with puppets and in-camera effects, you know?
Oh, that movie where Kirsten Stewart's running around half-naked the whole time. That movie also.
Underwater.
Yeah, underwater. That's what I remember from the movie. A very fucking fit Kirsten Stewart running around with her fucking Sigourney Weaver hair. You know, her Ripley hair. Fake-ass Ripley's running around.
Yeah, and it was the Thulu Mining Company. It was like, oh,
yeah, I get it. Yeah, they really...
Not real subtle there, guys.
But, we didn't cover this film, but I have to say, not to stray away from In the Mouth of Madness, that the a lot of those effects were practical, and they're amazing.
Yeah, they did a pretty good job with the effects on that movie. The movie itself is, it's okay. It's not...
Because you're, like, really in the water with the cameras, and...
Yeah.
They were doing a whole bunch of crazy stuff. They had, like, the puppet...
Yeah, they had puppets going. They had... They did it the right way in that movie. They used a lot of practical effects and puppets, and then just enhanced them with CG.
Yeah.
They removed the wires. They removed the arm of the guy that had the puppet in the one where they were showing it like he was working the puppet, biting him. But you could clearly see his arm, so they just cut his arm out of the picture.
It was mad impressive, because when you first watched a movie, you're like, okay, you're just taking it like any other movie. It's a movie with, you know, crazy shit happening in CGI. But then... finding, like, looking in the behind the scenes and saying, OMG, that was not CGI. A lot of, you know, was enhanced, like you said, and there are certain parts, but there weren't a lot.
Yeah, they didn't just film it all on a green screen through that one. They, you know, they had built practical sets. The sets were, like, 6-7 feet tall, and then they just enhanced above that, which, again, I didn't notice it. It looked like it was all pretty seamless. Yeah. So they did a good job with the effects on that one.
But, and the effects on this one, you know, it's still...
It still holds up pretty well.
There's some effects. It still holds up okay.
There's still a couple. There's a couple that are a little like, ooh, I see what they were going for there, but they didn't quite make it.
Yeah.
The like scene where she's kind of twisting her head around, and that would have been a lot easier to do with CGI now, because you could very clearly see that that was a mask she was wearing on the back of her head.
So Sutter Kane is as popular, the more popular Stephen King.
Yep.
And he's writing a novel.
Called... In the Mouth of Madness. I think this movie may have invented meta, by the way.
And then you have him, the publishing company can't find him. They're looking for him because he hasn't turned in pages in a long time. They haven't heard from him.
Yeah, he doesn't have the finished, they haven't got the finished book, and the deadline to publish it's approaching. And people are already, like,
they're
riding.
Right in line.
Yeah, they're in line. They're riding in the streets for this book. So they need to get this book. So they hire Sam Neill to, you know, find Sutter Kane. And I love how he first goes about it. He figures out that all the covers of the Sutter Kane books, if you cut them all apart and rearrange them like a puzzle... It makes a map of the state of New Hampshire with a dot where Hobbs End is supposed to be, which is where several of his novels took place. So it's his own little Castle Rock. And that's where he starts looking for Sutter Kane. And funny enough, he brings with him from the publishing company, he brings a woman to help him. And it's
Julie Carmen,
who was in Fright Night 2 that we covered just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, she was... Chris Sarandon's sister.
Yeah. Which is weird. I had forgotten about that. And it's funny that we ended up covering two movies with the same person in it.
Didn't even realize she was in this movie. I thought she just did Fright Night 2 and some other little things here and there, but wasn't in this film. I would have definitely lost that trivia badly.
Yeah, I didn't remember it either.
It's been a really, really long time.
So they head out to Hobbs End, and to say that they have an eventful journey is mild, because I think anytime you drive to a place and you start looking down and it looks like the car is driving just in darkness, there's nothing below you, no road, no sky, nothing, you're just in a black void driving, it's probably a good time to just turn the hell around and go home. But they kept on going.
Yeah, there's creepy stuff that happens while they're on the road, and it doesn't make any sense. Like, you're like... And for me, the whole movie is definitely the breakdown of reality. Not only for the person, not only for Sam Neill, who's just a regular person coming into a situation, and it does not go well. Then you have... It spreads to, like... everyone, like humanity basically, and it's like this virus that's taking over, and there's nothing that nothing is going to be done. There's no hero that's coming in, because Sam Neill is definitely just a victim in this thing.
Yeah, there's no one in this movie they're like, oh, they're an occult expert and they know how to do black magic and they know how to reverse this and all that. No, it's all just regular people. No one's like a martial arts badass. No one knows about the occult or any of that. They all just kind of stumble into it, and then they realize how fucked everybody is.
Yeah, I mean, you can't have the ending to an apocalypse trilogy without it all going to fucking hell, right? Pun intended. Yeah. And it does, because it just keeps unraveling from the point that they step into Hobbs End, you know, and they go through a whole bunch of crazy shit, and they find, you know, Sutter Kane,
who is Jürgen Proch now. Who is...
The name alone should just be like, he's a crazy looking dude.
Yeah, he's a crazy dude. He's been...
In a good way, not like in a bad way.
Yeah, anytime you see him in a movie, he's either the villain or he's the very creepy guy that's going to help out the heroes in some way, but not... You're not really sure if he's really going to help them or not. He's that guy.
Was he in Constantine? I feel like he may have been in Constantine.
I don't know if he was in Constantine or not. The main place I know him from is Das Boot. He was the commander in that, the sub-commander in that movie.
Crickets.
Yeah.
So, you know, is it
the 4-hour long submarine movie?
No. Why did... Okay.
Now, in German.
Now we're straying away. Why did you watch this 4-hour movie? Did you really watch the 4-hour movie? Did you do, like, the best, like, scenes of Das Boot you really saw?
No, I watched the whole movie.
Why, though?
It's a popular, famous movie. I wanted to see it.
Wow. I'm mad. Like, I don't... Impressed, I guess. I mean, to sit through that kind of a movie, I would not sit through that movie. I don't even want to sit through a normal movie for 2 hours. I'm like, I gave up watching critically acclaimed films a long time ago. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was the last thought-provoking movie I saw. Wow, Jesus. No, that's not true. I've seen some stuff. But, you know, I just devoted my life to horror.
Yeah, what I heard somebody one time say, the first 90 minutes of a movie are free. After that, you got to earn it. It's like, so it better be real good after the first 90 minutes. I'm like, okay, that is kind of fair, but...
Oh. Well,
Ghost Rider's leaving. He's getting the hell out of here. Just talking about Sutter Kane.
He's like, I'm getting the fuck out. That guy's fucking nuts. And he drives away.
And yeah, you hear it. It goes his way.
There's smoke coming out. Oh my goodness.
We may be tired on this episode, so it's gone a little off the rails.
No, it's not gone off the rails. It's on the damn rails, and it is freaking hilarious. I'm all about it. So, as we've said, it is just, there's, what's your favorite part in the film?
To me, my favorite part is the, when he goes to meet him in the, like, black church. And he's talking to Sutter Kane and realizes just how, you know, crazy everything is. And Sutter Kane just, like, rips himself in half and just disappears. And you're like, oh, okay, that just happened. That's where you're like, you see that? I don't know how you just stay normal after that. Like, you see a guy just, like, rip himself in half like paper and disappear. It's like, oh, okay. Yep, let me just go curl up in the corner over here. Why did he even run from the monsters? Just give up. You know they're coming.
Yeah, I would have just given. I would have just... laid down and taking a nap, close my eyes and be like, it's over.
Because the whole thing is, you see him, he's trying to hide the copy that he has of the In the Mouth of Madness. He's like, no, I'm going to burn this shit. Nobody's going to read it. Then you find out later, oh, no, all that happened months ago. We got the book. It's fine. Like, oh, shit. How long has he been out of it?
A long time.
That's where you realize just how fucked everything is, because what you're seeing is not what happened. It's just what he remembers. And he may have been just roaming around in the woods or in the highways or whatever for months. And by the way, the bus ride he takes is pretty much like any bus ride I've ever had in my life. Creepy people all around you, screaming, sleeping, smelly, disturbing. Yeah, that's any bus ride I've ever been on.
That's just like the most horrifying part of the movie for you then.
Yes, it is, because literally I've only been on a bus like twice, and both times it was that bus ride where someone just woke up screaming in the night. And you're like, God damn, I'm only on this bus for like 4 hours and it's already been a nightmare. So yeah, no, I've never been back on one.
I have to say, I love when you're very up on the details of the movie, because there was one, like, we're watching the movie and then you're like, Sutter Kane's favorite color is blue and the film is blue. I'm like, what?
Yeah, I was like, yeah, that's where he, it's especially prevalent in the bus scene where he says that, and like everything in the bus is blue. People are all wearing blue and you're like, oh shit. But even throughout the movie, the blue is everywhere. Everybody has blue eyes. So it shows just how much he's fucking with everything,
Yeah, it's really unsettling. The scene that freaks me the fuck out is the innkeeper who is behind a counter and she's talking to Sam Neill or whatever, and then he walks away and she gets agitated and the camera pans down from behind the counter, like shows from the front of the counter, goes pants to the other side, and you see her husband is naked and chained to her fucking ankle, and you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Which you knew that she was off, because when they get to Hobbs End, they're like, the publicist or whoever the fuck is with him, Julia Carmen, she is telling him these are the characters, and they're telling each other, because he just read the novels, oh, this is the crazy old lady who owns the inn, who has like her husband in the like basement or whatever, that she killed him to bits or whatnot. So you know that she's a little touched, but you're hoping that she isn't, that it's just in the story, and the story hasn't really come to life.
But no, it has.
And then my other favorite, and I wish someone would make this movie, or give me the money, I'll make the movie. I have this obsession with people in paintings. And when they first get there, there's a couple standing beside the water in a painting, and some weird shit happens in the painting. And I've always thought it would be a cool movie to have a story about that. Like, that also happened in The Witches in the beginning. The little girl that was lost in the freaking little town, she was trapped by a witch in the painting, and she sat in the painting her whole life, like, overlooking the freaking family that, oh my god, I just... And the only one that knows that she's in the painting is the freaking witch that put her there. That kind of story intrigues the fuck out of me. So yeah, that scene with the painting, love it. That's my favorite scene, when they show that whole thing. And then you keep seeing it change as they're staying there. Different weird shit is happening in the painting. So there's like another story.
Yeah, I'd like to know what was going on there.
In the painting itself.
It's one of those things, like, you just want to see a little bit more of that, like, what the hell was going on there? Because I get the feeling, like, maybe that was Sutter King when he was younger doing stuff. Like, he's there in the town with, like, someone he cares about. Yeah, they don't explain... How he unraveled all that. And that'd be an interesting one to see, too, is, like, exactly how he did all this. And did he do it on purpose? Did he do it on accident? And then just realize, well, I'm fucked. I might as well just go with it.
Yeah. Well, who knows? We'll never know. We just,
because John Carpenter will never tell you.
No, he definitely won't tell. I know. I asked him a question about a scene in the Halloween movie. He declined to answer. So,
yeah,
was fine. It was his right to decline, but I was, it always bugged me, so I had to ask. So yeah, he's definitely not going to give the answer.
No, and I've seen people ask him, like, who's the thing? And he's just like, who do you think was the thing? That wasn't it.
It's obviously Childs.
Yeah, I know, but he's just like, he'll just literally say whatever it is at the one. He was like, no, that's not it. Like, so it was him. No.
You know what it was? The guy smoking behind the camera. It was fucking John Carpenter. He was the thing.
Yeah, I love that in Halloween when the skull comes. You read that one when the girl asked him, like, "Who? What's the deal with that smoke that comes
up?" It was a young girl, too.
What's the deal with that smoke that comes up from the camera in Halloween? He goes, "What the hell do you think the deal was with the smoke? I was smoking." John Carpenter's going to be one of those people that lives to 105 and smokes 4 packs a day the whole time.
For real.
Because that's all. That may be all that's keeping him alive is cigarettes at this point.
The whole time he was on the panel, all he wanted was the panel to end so then he could go smoke. I think actually there was a part where he actually left the panel to go smoke and then came back.
Yeah.
Did that happen? I feel like that happened. Did.
He said he'd be right back. Then he left everybody else talking. He came back and he needs to smoke. They should just make an exception for Carpenter and just let him smoke on the panel. Because I feel like if he was up there smoking and relaxed, he would tell a lot more things about the movies if he was just chilling out with these cigarettes.
I actually just want to make a movie about John Carpenter where I'm just video, like, taping him smoking the whole time. And he's just talking to me. I'm not even asking any questions. I'm just nobody. I'm just there in a room.
Just whatever he has to say.
And he's just going to talk and just smoke cigarette after cigarette after cigarette. Maybe play a basketball game, you know. Maybe shoot the hoops. Who knows?
He does play online basketball a lot. Can you imagine finding out you're playing online basketball and it's John Carpenter?
I hate basketball, but I would fucking become a master if that meant that I can play with him. I would do that.
Well, when I saw Nathan Fillion at that one convention, he said he plays Halo online a lot. And he does some of the voices on one of the Halo games. He said that people would be like, "Hey, you sound just like so-and-so in the game." And he'd be like, "Yeah, that is weird." Just go
on with it. Classic Nathan Fillion. I love it. It's great. So this film, like we said, wrapped up. We probably should have... It would have been cool to have seen... I mean, we've done the thing. We haven't done Prince of Darkness.
We haven't really done the thing. We've just talked about it in the past. We haven't covered either one of those yet.
Shit, we haven't covered the... In my mind, we covered it. Okay, we didn't cover it. But we've talked. We've definitely talked about it.
It's coming up at the drive-in here. 1st of October, they're going to do the Silver Moon drive-in here. Both screens are going to do a Howl All Night. It's going to be 5 movies on each side. And one of them is all the classic monster movies. And one of them is The Thing, American Werewolf in London. I think The Purge, Get Out, and something else. I can't remember the other one.
I want to go to the classic side.
Yeah, I kind of do too. It'd be good to see like Dracula and all that on the big screen.
Yeah, that would be pretty amazeballs to see that.
Yeah, they're doing Dracula, Frankenstein, mm-hmm. like Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, The Creature, and one more. I can't remember.
Because we've seen The Thing at the Antian.
It was at the Tampa Theater.
Oh, we saw it there, yes. Yep. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us while we wrap up. I believe this is our last
double feature. Next week, we're going back to regular, one movie at a time.
One movie at a time. And then, you know what happens on Tuesdays? We have our second serving, where we serve up a delicious, obviously, second film of part of, you know, probably usually a trilogy or non-trilogy. But we haven't done a second film of, like, a long length, like, series yet, have we?
No, we haven't really covered any, like, Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street yet.
Yeah. I don't know, because it's like, not that they're not important, but I'd like to do more of those one-off ones.
Yeah, like Fright Night 2, and, you know, like we did Fright Night 2, and we even did Blade 2, and that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's interesting to do some of the lesser-known ones.
Blade 3 doesn't exist.
What? Ooh, yeah, that movie was terrible.
Terrible. I couldn't stop watching Stephen Dorff's, like, hairline.
That's the first movie.
Oh, my God. I always do this! This happened too when we were watching the other movie. Damn it. Ryan Reynolds is in the third one.
Yes.
Damn, Ryan Reynolds.
But yeah.
Deadpool did not pull off that movie.
No, but I think the best part of Blade 3 is just the behind the scenes stories where they were like, Wesley Snipes was just so high all the time that they used his stunt double for like 90% of the movie.
That's insane. Oh my God. Why do I keep, you know, I have to watch Blade 1 again because I always think that first movie is the second movie or the third movie. Yeah. I don't know why.
Yeah, we talked about it just a couple of weeks ago.
I know. It's so bad. I just actually have just erased all those movies. I did an Eternal Sunshine movement, and I just erased all of those films from my mind. And then I just, like, there's just little pieces that stay in, and I'm like, oh, it's this. Okay, well, you know how I feel about the hairline, so we're done. Thank you so much, and stay tuned to the horror.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.